It's here, it's afternoon in Cape Town. Mohammed, I'm pleased that you've accepted to have this conversation with me on your writings. So you're welcome. I would like to start by you briefly introducing yourself to our listeners.
Thank you very much, Francis. And it's just afternoon here in London. And good afternoon to you too. My name is Mohammed Umar, as you have said, and I live in London. I'm from Nigeria originally, from Bauchi State. I studied in Moscow before I came to the United Kingdom roughly about 30 years ago, and I have worked here in four mainstream publishing houses. I have written and published 8 books. I have some stories that have not yet been published, and I have worked as the rights manager, as a sales manager, as a marketing manager, and as a publisher for this four main mainstream publishing houses. And my books have been translated into, well, at the moment, I think 84 languages, but all in all, I'm expecting 106 by the end of the year, which is about 70 African languages, 30 European languages, roughly about 70 African languages, 30 Asian languages, about 10 European languages. Well, some might drop, and I'm still working on others. And I think that's enough for introduction, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in it, you've captured the various aspects I would like you to develop further in this conversation. First, your publications and translation into different languages. But before I come to that, perhaps just to give a background to this conversation. I remember I first met you in London when you were working at Z Books, and you were a rights person, and my conversations with you were very exciting, and you were well entrenched in publishing. So I was surprised when I started receiving, when you branch into writing, and I've read Amina, I've read Samad in English, I read The Adventures of Jamil, basically I would like you to share with our listeners what in your experiences as a publisher pushed you to consider taking up writing as well.
Okay, just a little bit of other background information. I started writing when I was a student at the Moscow State University, Faculty of Journalism, which was from 1980s. I went there 85, I finished 91, but I wrote Amina when I was in my first year, 1987. I finished writing it in 1987. And so, actually, the Heinemann African Writers series, strangely enough, accepted to publish it, and that's how I came to the UK when I finished studying in Moscow. That was 1991. And as soon as I arrived, and they said, rewrite it, I rewrote it. And the next thing I got from them was that the list has been cancelled, and so they are not going to publish by now. And then the novel remained in the flat while I was trying to sort out myself out, either with my residency and other issues, of course. That's how I became an illegal immigrant, and that's a different story because I wrote my semi-autobiographical novel called The Illegal Immigrant based on my experiences. And then I became legal and I got a job at Z Books, and I'm so grateful to quite a few people for that job because it was an eye-opener. Just to say that I have written a book before we met, but it wasn't published.
Yes.
It opened my eyes considerably, because as you will agree with me, publishing is a white man, you know, it's a something exclusively white. I mean, not until recently. It was monopolized by a tiny elite. I mean, we know the role knowledge plays in every civilization, but this monopoly of knowledge by this white elite made it difficult for Africans or people of other races to get into mainstream publishing in the UK. I was one of the very, very lucky ones, because I was, and you see it on display at the book fairs. I mean, about 20-something years ago, Frankfurt Book Fair, we were only three or four black publishers. I mean, one from America, one from Jamaica, and later, Brian started coming in from South Africa, and I'm the only one from the UK. I mean, can you imagine the whole book fair? So it was a real eye-opener, and you find out that even now that they're allowing a lot of black people into mainstream publishing, you still find that the gatekeepers, the editors, still remain, come from a certain group, certain, you know, they have certain education, and that's how they make sure we get a particular type of knowledge we have. So the whole architecture of publishing is constructed without even the Africans, just like so many other institutions in the world, without Africans in it. So we are just the consumers of a lot of the knowledge they produce. This is well known to a lot of Africans. It's nothing new. And so this is one of the things I found very painful, because you find out that you come with your own experiences and with your ideas, and you find someone who finished Cambridge or Oxford or one of these universities and tell you, no, I know better than you because I read this professor who is probably a white man, and he said this, and so it was so painful. And I found the degree at which they reject this outrightly is just revolting. I mean, because they cannot see things from the African perspective, so everything has to suit their culture. And in some cases, they get some of these writers, African writers, to write things that suits their market. And very, very annoying, you know. And no, if you can change it to this, I say, no, I'm not going to change it. This is what I want to write. So these are the things that really annoy me. I mean, maybe annoying is not the right word. Push me into it. I will write my own. And above all, I understood how the publishers world works.
Exactly.
So I said, it's so simple, you know. I know if you everything you understand is simple. So I said, I can write. So I can write more, and then I can publish myself. All I have to do is do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things, because these are the experiences I've learned from where I've worked. And luckily, Zen Books is small. We're only 9 or 10 sometimes. Yeah. And then you get the production manager is next to you, the sales manager. I was under the sales manager. The editor is there. So you can hear the composition. When they are not around, you do the jobs for them. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you do the jobs for them. You cover. And that's how I learned that, hang on, if I publish my book, I can take it through the same process and get it out there. I may not make money, because again, the vital, the most important part of publishing is distribution. I don't have a distributor, at least at that time. But at least I will write what I want, publish it, and it to be out there, and I will go to bed satisfied. My conscience is clear that I have written something, and it is out there, and it's what I want that is out there.
Yes. And in fact, that brings me to the second question. Based exactly on your experiences at Zed Books, because one thing is that you've since moved on to write and publish. You've written 8 books, and Amina was the first. And 3 of your books for me have been translated, or maybe there are more, but the ones that stand out for me into various languages is Amina and Samad, both in the desert and in the forest. It is phenomenal how much translation you have done. In fact, it humbles Chinua Achebe's experience in Things Fall Apart, which has been presented as the most translated of in over around the world into over 50 languages or so. So clearly, you are top. You are doing very well in this regard, and I would like you to share your personal experiences in this way using Amina and Samad.
Okay. Yeah. Then, as we speak, I'm still working on a few. Samad in the Forest tops the list with 64 languages.
Yeah.
Then Samad in the Desert comes next with 42, I think. It keeps changing because 1 minute you get sometimes a drop. Amina, which I consider to be my seminal work, and is on the condition of women in northern Nigeria, has been translated and published in 36 languages, including 16 Indian languages. And this is a novel, a big 240-something pages. I don't know how I did it. I mean, of course, I knew it started. Like every other thing, it starts with one, and then you keep pushing, and then you keep pushing. But to do this, Francis, you have to understand, I have this advantage of knowing how it works inside. And the only way you can get things done is to bypass things. You see, the Chinese are conquering the world by bypassing the neoliberal structures or the old, world system that was in place, that was made to serve the West. So because I knew what was inside, how it operated, I was the rights manager at Z Books for 11 years. So while at Z, I realized that there are certain ways in which things have been structured to benefit the business environment of the West. And there is the only way you can publish and distribute and get your books out there is to go around it somehow. I started with the belief that every writer wants to be read. And you are a writer if you are read. It doesn't matter how many and where. But the way the business publishing here is business, and profit is the motive.
Yeah.
Then I said, okay, well, if I remove the profit out of this, I will probably be able to push things forward. And it worked. As soon as sometimes you say, look, I want to be read in this language. I don't care whether I make money or not. What does it take? And then you go and look. I went out and looked for I was also lucky because I found book loving people who said, oh, if you have come this far, I will help you. I mean, sometimes people came to me from different parts of the world. Sometimes I had to go all the way to India, to Japan, to China, looking for publishers for my books because I want to be read in those languages. And I had to go there and say, look, I have this book. This is it. Can you publish it? Sometimes they say, no, get off. Sometimes they listen to me. And that's how I got to where I am with Amina. Amina looks at the condition of women in northern Nigeria, and I think that's why it appeals to publishers in India because of the level of poverty, inequality, and oppression.
Yeah.
But it has also done well with left-wing publishers in the West, and like in Finland, some of these women group published it in Azerbaijan, women's group. So they use it to educate women. With Samad, I thought, you know what? Let me concentrate on Africa. It's a small book. I have the rights to everything. I am the publisher. Instead of charging people, what if I set up my own publishing? By this time, I have Salam Publishing. What if I get a translators around Africa to translate and I publish? And that's what I've been doing. So, and how do you get these translators? Sometimes you meet them at the book fair, sometimes you talk to publishers on the ground, but sometimes, in most cases, I call the main universities in these countries, like, for example, I call Namibia, and then I say, look, the university, do you do languages like this? Put me through to your languages department. They put me through. Who is your head of department? They put me through. Head of department, I want somebody to translate this small text, 3 pages long or 2 pages long, over the weekend, and I will pay so and so amount.
Yes.
That's the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I got a lot of languages. As for, there are some languages that I will publish, like main language. In Kenya, I have 4 languages. I publish them, and I have somebody on the ground to do it in Swahili, and he's doing well. But sometimes I get somebody on the ground to do it first, because I want African children to read this story. You know how expensive books are, £8 or £10 if they are sold in the West.
Yeah.
So I do my best to get African publishers to publish on the ground. So now I pay the translator, and sometimes I pay them, the publishers. I say, do it and subsidize it for the kids. Like it's something like it's a place like Cameroon, I got someone who is doing it in 12 languages, African languages.
Yes.
There's no point I would do and publish them in the West,
yes,
in London.
Yes.
I got him to do it. Like African and Ghanaian languages, Creole in Sierra Leone, and Zambia. You know, I did those ones hoping that along the line I would get somebody on the ground to do it. In South Africa, for example, there is a lady who is doing it in 10 South African languages. Of course, Corona has affected 1 or 2 people, issues, and then I'm now doing it. I did it in 5 South African languages here in London, but now I've taken over to do 3 others. So this is how, you work. You don't have one strict, I don't have one strict approach. I have 3 approaches. One, I get someone on the ground to do it. Sometimes we do it together, and sometimes I do it alone. If I have a translator now to do it in Mende, I will do it, because I don't have anybody in the radio to do it.
Yeah. Do you sometimes feel, are you sometimes concerned that about the quality of the translation to ensure that the story that the end of reading is actually your story as initially intended? The question was, are you sometimes concerned about the quality of the translation, that what is actually made available to the reader is the material as you intended in terms of content? Yeah.
Yes and no. Yeah, I will start with no. I don't understand what is written in Sanskrit, so I can go on and be worried without, for till kingdom come, and I will not know anyway.
Yeah.
So that's the. So I'm not worried, but I have been unbelievably lucky. And as I told you earlier, I used to go straight to the head of the department, order the best translators.
Yeah.
I've been lucky with translators. And almost 9 out of 10, and I do sample it with people on the ground here, or I share it with other people. And they've all come back to me to give me the best. My translators have been great. The Arabic translator is one of the best translators. The French translator, she's based here, of Amina, she's based in France. She's a well-known translator. And the Somali translator, these are my classmates and friends. So I have been lucky. Like the Creole translator, he is based in U.S. He's a professor from Sierra Leone based in the U.S. and he translated it and he consulted people. Now, while I'm on this, let me share a few things with you, Francis.
Okay.
What did I have observed? It's a huge learning curve going through. You must agree that this is a huge learning curve.
Absolutely.
And there's no textbook.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm considering writing my experiences,
Yeah.
Francis, a lot of African languages don't have the names for something like illustrator.
Yes,
I'm not
yes.
laughing because of
yeah.
animator.
Yeah.
Or I think there was one who has even didn't even have a award for award winning.
Yes. Yes.
So, I am not laughing because there are so many things that I just found that we are lacking. And a lot of these translators, especially the African translators, would delay something or last minute call me and say, I've talked to this, and 4 of us could not agree what we should use for the even Leopard.
Yes.
For this simple Atmos. I mean, I am Hausa. The BBC Hausa service here, I don't mind, I'm sure they knew you, I won't mention their names. They tried to translate one of my books into Hausa.
Yes.
One of my friends. I've known them for more than 30 years.
Yes.
And then names with names of animals and simple things like oasis.
Yes.
In one part of Nigeria, oh, it's called Fadama. In other place, it's called something else. In Niger, it's called something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took 3 months for this text going around from academics to come to an agreement. I mean, this is just a short story. Can you imagine, you know, what it took for Amina? It took 2 years of big discussion between two universities, Ahmadu Bello University and Usman Dabodio University, to decide on so many things on Amina. And that's how I told you I'm so lucky, because almost every language, the translators, to the best of my knowledge, were very faithful, and they went to full extent, you know, they went to extreme, you know, to make sure they saw clarification in the use of words, you know, because a lot of African languages simply, and I mean, another one, in, for example, in Congo, he just published a book in Lingala.
Yeah.
You know, I told him, and in French, and I said, in the forest story, I said, what about desert? He said, Mohammed, Congo is good, we don't have desert, I don't know any, I don't know how to translate it into desert.
Yeah, exactly. So translation is a challenge, but it should not stand in the way of sharing one's stories and one's experiences, I think.
Absolutely not. It's a huge challenge. Yeah. And until you go, and, you know, until you go, and when you first come across it, you just say, no, I can't do this. And a lot of translators will start by no. I said, look, you can do it. Then, of course, then I say, okay, what's the incentive? This is what I give. I will give you this. Okay, I will double it. Because I wanted it that much. You see?
Yeah.
But then, having said that, Francis, let me add, not all of them, you know, but me, there is a lady, and I'm not going to mention her name, from one of African country. I said, I want you to do this. She said, wow, you want to put my language out there? I said, yeah. She saw my website, she saw what I've been doing. She said, I'll do it for free. I said, no. You know, she just translated it, Sunday. I said, tell me your full name so that I would send it in what I want to send you. She refused to get money. She said, well, so I'm not saying they do it for money. Some will, of course, you meet all kinds of people in life. Some would ask for money, and some, you know, would not. And I mean, I had to force her to accept something, you know, because I remember I was just about to print when she called me and said she went to the village, a village somewhere, and consulted an expert, and she had to make 4 changes to my text.
Oh, wonderful. Very dedicated. Huh?
Yeah.
Mohammed, the very last section is, I would like you to send a message to African writers, as well as a message to African readers. The choice is yours, which one to start with?
I will start with readers, because to be honest with you, I haven't had a lot of interaction with African readers, because Amina is only out in 4 African languages, and I'll have more interaction with Indian, Indonesian, Malaysian, and Japanese readers in terms of Amina. I also, Samad is out in all these languages, but of course, this is for children, so I haven't really had that much. But I will ask African readers to do one thing. They should demand more from their writers. You know, they should put writers under pressure, you know, to write more on what affects the continent. But above all, please make it clear to African writers, stop pandering to Western audiences and write things that, you know, and go the extra mile to get your books available in Africa. Do whatever it takes. It doesn't take a lot, to get it out there. You just have to jump all these hurdles. Now, the reason why I'm saying this, Francis, is that the way it has been demarcated, the present structure suits Western writers. They can just write, sit down, and forget about the marketing, the sales, and the consumption. Whereas for African audience, it's different. You have to make sure, like I did, you have to make sure your books are out there. African publishers, you said?
No, African writers. African writers,
The first thing is keep writing, whether you're published or not. And especially in this day and age that you can just upload your book, it has its upside and downside. So the, of course, on the outside, is you don't have the gatekeepers who would refuse to publish you. Now you can just put it on Amazon. But the absence of gatekeepers also, and the people want to are in a rush to see their books out there. Sometimes books of very, very low quality are produced.
Yeah.
They don't want this is something different. You have, and you have to be courageous. Courage is everything. You just have to say, look, I have written this book, and the reader in Norway can gain from it. You don't have to wait for an agent. I didn't wait for an agent. You know, I thought my book would do well in India. I went to India, and look at the results, 16 Indian languages.
Yeah.
Actually, I just got 3 more yesterday. So what I'm saying is, you don't know, you don't know if you can fly until you try your wings.
Yeah.
A lot of African writers are just content with, you know, writing in their, in whatever French, English language, whatever, or Portuguese, and that's it.
Yes.
And for this particular audience, no, you got to try moving from one subconsciousness to the other. I mean, there is fun in it, there is joy in it, it's magic to sit down and look at your book in a language that you have absolutely no clue even how your name is written. So you should try it. There are audience out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me conclude by revisiting the idea of translation into various languages. What you have achieved here, which many of the prominent translated writers, including Achebe, may not have achieved, is translation into languages that are little known, languages within various African settings, languages in India, languages that in the global competition for visibility may not feature much, but they are nonetheless important to those who speak them. So I can very well see, given how successful you are in this regard, to end up as the most translated writer ever. But some who like to quibble might argue that although you are very well translated, The languages are almost inconsequential because they would not even qualify in some considerations as languages, you know, in a disparaging sense. If you were to meet people who quibble like that about all the efforts you have made, what would your answer be to them?
To be honest with you, I have not actually thought about it. It was only about a month ago or so that someone drew my attention to the fact that I was just discussing it with someone, and he said, Mohammed, how many languages do you think you are going to have by the end of this time next year? I said, 110. He said, do you know that? And how many? And I told him, and then I had 90 almost off the shelf. He said, do you know that, Mohammed, you are the only living person waking up to see 90 languages on the shelf? I said, really? He said, yeah. J.K. Rowling is 85. He said he went and did all the research, and he said Agatha Christie is the most translated writer.
Agatha Christie?
The Guinness Book of Record holder, or someone, the person in the Guinness with the most translated foreign languages, is Agatha Christie, and she's got 103 languages.
Yeah.
At the moment, if everything works according to plan, I will have 103 languages by the end of the year, probably 106. Now, yes, if you look at her list, I haven't checked, you will say there is no Ewe, there is no Kavye, these are languages that, you know, people don't even know where the countries where they are spoken. But to me, a language is a language. Of course, I think there will be a lot of people who will say that for obvious reasons. You know, they'll say 70 African languages, that's nothing. But as long as it's in Wikipedia that it's a language, I think it qualifies. That's a language. I did not put it in. So we'll see. When we get there, to be honest, I have not really thought of what I will tell them when I meet them. I'm just at the moment I'm trying to push and make sure that as many people as possible out there read me. Yeah,
absolutely. I think you have a point. You did mention a possible answer in passing when we started, by saying that every writer expects to be read, and the more people that read you, the better you feel, the more you feel fulfilled, and everybody has got a story to tell, and the story has to circulate. So the quibbling around which language has greater value is neither here nor there, as long as there are people who speak that language and expect to be understood in it. I would say.
And while you're on it, sorry, let me just mention one experience I had. You know that there is a book club in Sierra Leone that actually circulates books on WhatsApp. Now, how do you define that?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You see?
Yeah.
So when here they would say, "Oh, she's successful a writer because she sold 1 million copies." Fine. What about if 1 million Sierra Leoneans on WhatsApp read this person's poem?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Now that's a major thing to consider. The place of enabling technologies such as social media, and you've mentioned WhatsApp, that makes it possible for a single copy, as long as it's electronic, to circulate widely, while a hard copy would not be able to achieve the same level of readership by moving from hand to hand. Okay, so one last word.
Thank you very much for the invitation and for the time, and let's keep writing, let's keep reading, and let's keep pushing the boundaries.
Thank you very much, Mohammed. It's been great speaking with you, and I hope I will make this available, and hopefully others would read and reach out to you and continue this conversation.
Thank you.
Okay.